care setting for more than 9 years. In that time, she has become recognized as an expert on assessing and managing pain, as well as on advancing pain care to older adults. Jill has published several articles and book chapters on pain management and lectures extensively on pain management in a variety of healthcare settings. Jill considers herself a strong advocate for the care of patients in pain. The pain management program that she designed, implemented, and now coordinates has been recognized by JACO, the Joint Commission, for best practice in long-term care management. Please join me in welcoming Jill Loeb today.
Good morning. It's nice to see so many of you here despite the rain. In the interest of pain management, we probably should have done something about the weather, huh? Regardless, I'm delighted to see you all here today, and I'm delighted to have the opportunity to talk to all of you about some practical strategies that we can utilize to assess and manage pain in our residents. We know that the long-term care setting is very different than the acute care setting, than the home setting, really than any other setting. And so the strategies we use for our residents have to be different as well. This is Ken. Ken be better. Ken is cognitively impaired, rarely speaks in other than gibberish words. He's been restless lately, having difficulty sleeping, refusing to ambulate, only picking at his food. And oh yes, he's been beating up his caregivers. Have you all met Ken? He's living in every facility I've ever been in every state in the United States. Amazing, isn't it? So historically, how have we treated patients like Ken? What do? Restrain them. And usually, not only do we use physical restraints, we use chemical restraints, because thou shalt not hit the caregivers, right? Of course, we know that the Joint Commission and Department of Health are looking at our use of restraints. We know there is appropriate restraint use. There is appropriate psychotropic medication use. However, we need to know a little bit more about Ken's behavior before we initiate restraint use, don't we? We need to know a little bit more about what the etiology of the behaviors are. Historically, when faced with behaviors, we've treated behaviors. We need to look further, and we need to dig deeper. If we consider that over 4 million Americans live with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, just Alzheimer's disease, think about how pervasive cognitive impairment is. And think about your resident populations and the changes you've seen over the years. Are we seeing more and more cognitively impaired individuals? Sure. And are we seeing them at different levels of that cognitive impairment? Absolutely. And Alzheimer's is just one diagnosis. If we've got over 4 million Americans today, think about what that's going to be next year, 5 years from now, and 10 years from now. We know that the advanced healthcare system that we work and live in is helping these individuals to live longer lives. And therefore, we are charged with their care for longer periods of time. When we look at the prevalence of pain, if we look at community-dwelling elderly, it's believed that 25 to 50% of community-dwelling elderly have pain on a daily basis. Pain that's significant enough to infringe on activities of daily living and quality of life. When we turn to nursing home residents and look at the pervasiveness of pain there, those numbers jump dramatically. 45 to 83% of residents live with pain on a daily basis. Now, do you all know where I get those numbers? And I'll give you a hint, I didn't make them up. From the MDS. I got those numbers from all of you and the documentation that you all complete. And of course, when you all fill out the MDS, you all use the absolute same definition for pain. You all make the same judgments, and your observations are consistent from one surveyor to the next and one assessor to the next, right? No. Not really. And so what does that say to you about those numbers? Do you think those numbers are accurate? Do you think they are conservative? Yeah, they're pretty conservative. And we're talking about 45 to 83% of our residents. So let me ask you, I want you to think about your individual facilities for a moment. Do you think that you're treating 45 to 83% of your residents for pain? And it's a pretty mixed bag out there. I've seen three heads go yes. I've seen a lot more than three heads say no. And most of you didn't bother to answer. Now, you all have had coffee, so you all have to answer me when I ask you questions. That's the rules. We know that these numbers are conservative, and we know that many of our residents are not being adequately assessed or treated for pain. If we look just at osteoarthritis, and I chose osteoarthritis because we tend to think of it as very benign. If we look just at osteoarthritis, it affects greater than 80% of individuals over the age of 65. Now, I want you to think for a moment about your residents again. Do you think 80% of your residents are being treated for osteoarthritis? Probably not. And when we consider the pain from osteoarthritis, we need to understand that if you were to do a literature search or do some research within facilities, you would find that most have significant pain and that it is the leading cause of disability in our elderly. So what is pain anyway? When I say to you, we're going to talk about pain today, and we're going to look at pain, and I ask you about the pain that your residents experience, what's pain? What is it? You've got to do a little louder. Okay, I hear discomfort. What else? What else is it? Come on, you've all had coffee. Patient expression, looking at nonverbal signs. What else? Changes in activities of daily living, changes in behavior. What else? What is it?
Whatever someone says it is.
What else? Poor appetite. Unplanned weight loss. What else? Sleeplessness, insomnia. Anything else? Agitation. What is it? Dying, depression, sighing, anxiety. So I've gotten 10, 12 different answers, and there are probably 100 of you in the room. If I actually pushed the issue and had each one of you write down what pain is, how many different responses do you think I'd get? Pretty close to 100. So what does that say to us about our assessment of pain? We're all applying different definitions. We're all looking at it with our subjective eyes. We need to do better. Now, the American Pain Society and the International Association for the Study of Pain actually have a definition for pain. Pain is an unpleasant sensory or emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage or defined in terms of such damage. Are y'all impressed by this definition? Come on, this is impressive. Be impressed. Thank you. Words. Is this clinically useful? No. Can you all go back to your facilities now and adequately assess your residents for pain? Using this definition? Probably not. Probably not. And so we need to look at pain a little bit differently. Did you all know the MDS actually has a definition for pain? It really does. And we're going to talk about it in a few minutes. And we're going to make sure that we're all on the same page so that we can do a better job in assessing our residents. And we can be a little bit more consistent. And the next time I come back to you with some statistics about the prevalence of pain, well, first of all, they're going to be more consistent and accurate. And second of all, hopefully they're going to be greatly reduced because y'all are going to do a better job. Let's talk about some of the causes of pain in our long-term care residents. Now, we can look at disease process. That's easy. Things like osteoarthritis, osteoporosis, pressure ulcers. We can look at edema, stroke,
contractures, neuropathies. We can look at cancer, fractures. We can look at falls and injuries. All of these are things we tend to think about when we ask about pain, right? The place where we fall short is with regards to the pain that we inflict. Yeah, we do that. Not because we're callous, mean, and sadistic, right? Right? I'm a little worried about this group. I think I'll just stand on this side of the podium until I get a little more comfortable with all of you. We need to think about pain that we inflict in the course of normal, appropriate medical care. And we do that. We insert PEG tubes. Now, for those of you who are clinical staff, you know what this entails. But some of you are not clinical, so I want to give you a little bit of a picture of this. What a PEG tube is, or a feeding tube is a tube inserted through the abdominal wall into the stomach that we use to feed a resident. Now, the way that we change these PEG tubes is we deflate the balloon that's holding this tube in place, and we pull it out. Then we take another tube, it's about this long usually, and we stick it back into the abdomen, through the layers of the abdomen, through the muscles, through the fascia, and into the stomach. Does this not sound pleasant? How many of you would like to sign up for the workshop I'm going to have in this afternoon? Oh, yeah, you all want to do this? You're all signing up to have a PEG tube inserted? Oh, yeah, you had to rethink that one. And if you're not thinking that a PEG tube would be a pleasant experience, let's talk about Foley catheters. Clinical staff, you all know what I'm talking about here. Non-clinical staff, think about that same tube we just inserted in the abdomen. Well, not the exact same tube. We're going to take a clean one. And we're going to insert that into the bladder. Now think about how it is that we get it into the bladder. Are you all getting a visual here? And how many of you would like to sign up for that one this afternoon? No takers. Imagine that. Now, I want you to think for a minute about how it is that we have to insert these tubes and the positions our residents have to be in order for us to do this. Does this sound real comfortable? Think about the 90-year-old contracted lady that you want to stick a Foley catheter in. How many staff do we usually have for a procedure like that? Usually two. And you know why? Because our 90-year-old contracted ladies can't sit there on their back with their legs apart, open and wide and everything else, for us to do this. And so we have to do this for them. This is not a comfortable thing. We insert IVs. We stick pointy objects into our residents. We do phlebotomy, blood draws, needles. Y'all want to sign up for a little blood draw this afternoon? No. Imagine that. And yet we do this routinely to our residents. I included turning and positioning here. Why did I include turning and positioning under pain that we inflict? Is that a painful procedure? Absolutely it could be. Imagine that 80-year-old contracted lady. Imagine turning them, how that must feel. And we do that because we don't want their skin to break down, right? So we generally turn them every 2 hours throughout the night. Doesn't this sound like a really restful evening for everyone? And then we wonder why our patients are cranky and nasty in the morning. We need to think a little bit about this. Then there's dressing changes. Normal, appropriate medical care, correct? Dressing change once a day, twice a day, three times a day, where we take adhesive tape and rip it off this very fragile skin. And we do it really quick, because you know what? I know it hurts, but if we do it really quick, like a Band-Aid, well, you know, I'll just be quick and it won't hurt that much. Don't we do that? How many times, nurses, have you said, I know it hurts, I'm just going to be really quick. We're almost there. And some of us sit there and do it really slowly because we don't want to rip the Band-Aid kind of thing off. And others of us do it really quick to get it over with. We inflict pain on our residents. And then, now think about this wound that we're going to clean really well to get rid of all the slough and drainage and make sure it's a really clean wound. How comfortable that must be on that raw skin. And then, of course, we can put in some packing. So now you've got a hole in, let's say, their butt, and we're going to pack that wound. And then we're going to put on more gauze or more dressing coverage and more tape on that thin, fragile skin. We inflict pain. And just because it's normal, appropriate medical care doesn't mean we can't treat the pain. Not only can we treat the pain, we need to practice preventative health care. We can preempt the pain. We need to premedicate for these dressing changes and potentially painful treatments that we do. And we're going to talk more about that throughout the course of the day. But I would hope that we can have a heightened awareness about the things that we do that inflict pain and realize and recognize that we can treat this. Pain is bad. Did you all know that? Historically, if we look at healthcare, we've said it's just pain. No one ever died from pain. Learn to live with it. Grin and bear it. Tough it out. Right? Right. And for those of you who think I might not be right about this, think about this. Think about the patient who just had major abdominal surgery. What's the very first thing we say to that patient? Cough. Take a deep breath. I don't want you to get pneumonia. I know it hurts. Just do it. Right? And now think about the patient that just had a hip replacement or a pinning. What's the first thing we say to that resident? Get out of bed. Stand up. I know it hurts. You must bear weight. You must range that joint. I know it hurts. Just do it. It's for your own good. That's how we've treated pain. And yet unrelieved and inadequately controlled pain has harmful effects on every system of the human body. If we look at the cardiovascular system, we see an increase in heart rate, blood pressure, and cardiac workload. We even see hypercoagulation. In the respiratory system, we see a decrease in peak flows and tidal volumes. We see atelectasis, pneumonia, hypoxemia. Now, I want you to think for a moment about your relatively healthy residents, and you probably have one or two in your facility. How long can they tolerate these effects? But what about your ill and debilitated residents? What about those who have cardiac disease, respiratory disease, COPD, asthma? How long can they tolerate these effects? In the musculoskeletal system, we see muscle wasting and atrophy, and we see immobility. And what's the number one adverse effect from immobility? What is it? Pressure ulcers, facility-acquired pressure ulcers. Y'all want to explain that to the surveyor? Well, gee, she was in so much pain I didn't turn her, and that's why she broke down. Y'all going to get away with unavoidable on that one? You will not. And we'll talk a little bit more about the state later on and the survey process. We need to change how we think about pain. I have a 12-year-old son, and he's kind of a little guy, which I know is hard to imagine considering my stature. He's a soccer player, and on a regular basis, he gets knocked on his butt. And the first thing we say is, get up, run it off, get back in the game, you're okay. You all catch that assessment I did in there? Talk about the hand is quicker than the eye. That's how we've looked at pain. Get back in the game, you're okay. And yet it has harmful effects on every system of the human body. We see a decrease in cognitive function and a decrease in immune response in individuals who live with unrelieved and inadequately controlled pain. When we say, or have heard colleagues say, no one ever died from pain, we need to rethink this, don't we? Other consequences of unrelieved and inadequately controlled pain include depression. Pain exacerbates depression, and depression exacerbates pain. The same is true for anxiety. And how do we treat depression and anxiety? Medication, psychotropic medication. Another one of those quality indicators, huh? We need to look at this. Because if we treat depression with antidepressants and the cause of the depression is pain, we're never going to get a handle on it. We need to look much more globally. We see decreased ambulation and deconditioning. We see decreased participation in activities of daily living. Another significant change that we need to document, isn't it? And whose workload is increased when we see a decreased participation in activities of daily living, ambulation, and deconditioning? The nursing assistants. And we all have plenty of nursing assistants, right? None of us have a problem with staffing. They're all really happy with their workload. We've got no problems there, right? Y'all are laughing at me. I'm guessing that means it's not the case. I know it's not the case in my facility. We see sleep disturbances. And how do we treat sleep disturbances in our residents? Medication, sedative hypnotics, yet another quality indicator. And of course, we're talking about a medication that has a very high risk of what? Falls, yet another quality indicator. Now, let me ask you all a question. If we are treating a sleep disturbance with a sedative hypnotic, and the cause of the sleep disturbance is pain, are we ever going to improve the sleep disturbance? Probably not. Increased healthcare utilization, changes in pain perception, physiological changes in the body when we fail to manage pain. Do you all know what the number one predictor of the development of a chronic pain syndrome is? Number one predictor, number one predisposing factor is inadequately treated acute pain. When we fail to treat pain, we actually create physiological changes in the human body that cause our patients and residents to develop chronic pain syndromes. Across the board, poor prognosis. Now, I'd like to know from all of you, if we know that pain is bad, and we all know that, and we know that pain is pervasive, what are the barriers you all see? Why don't we do a better job at assessing and managing pain in our residents? What gets in the way? What do you all see? What is it? The resident may not report pain or may not verbalize the pain. Maybe he's stoic. Maybe it's an alert resident. Just doesn't want to report pain. Fear of being labeled a bother. A complainer, a problem resident. Our residents know how hard we all work, and they don't want to make our jobs any harder. What else gets in the way? Cultural barriers, cultural beliefs, absolutely. And so we have a responsibility as healthcare providers to be aware of, particularly if we have certain cultures that feed into our facilities, to be aware of what those barriers are. What other barriers do you all see? No ideal pain medication. Interesting. We're going to talk about that later on. I'm not sure that's really accurate. I think a better answer might be that we're not using the arsenal of interventions available to us appropriately. There is no one-size-fits-all. Granted, there is some trial and error. But we do have an arsenal of interventions available to us. Other barriers that you see? Our own beliefs of what pain is and the subjectivity of pain. You all demonstrated it today when I asked you all what pain was. Other barriers. Fear of addiction. Oh, I heard that in four different places. Yeah, that one always comes up. And it's really interesting because I have to tell you, this is a problem that we all have caused as healthcare providers. And we've caused this problem because we really don't use an accurate definition of what addiction is. And so we need to talk about that. Addiction is a psychological dependence. It's a pattern of compulsive substance abuse and a need to use that substance for non-medical reasons despite the risk to oneself. Is pain a medical reason? Yes. So by definition, when we use a substance to treat pain, by definition, we've precluded addiction. Where we get into trouble is with the definition of physical dependence. Physical dependence has nothing to do with addiction. And if you look in the DSM-4 under the definition of addiction, you won't see physical dependence listed there. Physical dependence is the occurrence of withdrawal symptoms when a substance is abruptly stopped or suddenly tapered or following the administration of an antagonist. It's a pharmacologic and physiologic effect that we will see 100% of the time in our residents. 100% of the time. So why, when we see this, do we accuse our residents of being addicts? And we can preclude withdrawal symptoms if we appropriately taper our residents off their medications. So if we see withdrawal symptoms, it means we've done it wrong. And yet we blame our residents, don't we? What other barriers do you all see?
Lack of assessment skills,
absolutely. What else? Confused residents, those that are cognitively impaired, unable to report. What else? Language barriers, absolutely. Other barriers? Fear of what the pain means. Is disease advancing? Is death approaching? Is the pain retribution for something real or imagined they've done in their lives? What else? Ah, there it is. I have to tell you, you all win a prize. This is the first program I've ever done where physicians haven't come up in the top three. So you all win a prize. I'm not sure what it is. Maybe you just win the fact that I told you all are special. Either that or there are a lot of docs in the room and you all are being nice. Although I've yet to find a room where they've been that nice. Anyway, physicians always come up as a barrier. But here's the deal. We're not going to physician bash, and I'll tell you why. If physicians prescribed 100% perfectly everything that I would ask for in my ideal world, would we have good pain management? Absolutely not. And I'll tell you why. Who does the pain assessment? The nurse. Who does the administration of medication? Who evaluates the effectiveness of the administration? And you all communicate real well with your docs about what you're giving, how well it's working, and what you've seen in your residents. You will not physician bash. And that's why. This is an institutional problem. This is a system problem. We cannot blame one group of healthcare providers. This really is a system problem. And so it's very interesting for me, and it's been very interesting having the opportunity to work with the folks at iPro, where we're really looking at this as a quality improvement process. A systems issue, because that's the only way we're going to make a difference. It's not just nursing. It's not just physicians. It really requires an interdisciplinary approach and a system change to do better for our residents. Other barriers. We talked about impaired ability to report. Whether we're talking about a cognitive impairment like dementia, or how about a physical impairment like aphasia? Fear of being a bother, a complainer, a problem resident. How many of your residents truly believe pain is a normal consequence of aging? What do you think? Large percentage, huh? And yet pain is not a normal consequence of aging. Gray hair is normal, wrinkles are normal, pain is never normal. But the belief that it is pervasive among our residents, their families, and many of our colleagues and coworkers. And so many of our residents are resigned to living with pain. They've been living with pain for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. After all, you all are such wonderful healthcare providers. If you could have made their pain go away, certainly you would have by now. Fear of addiction, fear of side effects, fear that the treatment will be worse than the disease. Fear of the treatment. What are you going to need to do in order to make the pain go away? I had a resident many years ago in my facility when I first started in pain management who had a terrible diabetic neuropathy of her foot. We really had a tough time getting a handle on this pain. She begged to have her foot cut off. This woman wanted an amputation rather than to continue to live with the pain. Ultimately, we were able to get a handle on the pain, but it took some work and commitment. And by the way, we didn't have to cut off her foot. Inadequate pain assessment, resident reluctance to report, resident reluctance to take the medications that are appropriate for the treatment of pain, physician reluctance to prescribe, and we'll talk more about that later on, and across the board, inadequate knowledge of pain management. Whether we're talking about nurses, CNAs, recreation department, physical and occupational therapists, physicians, inadequate knowledge. we can do better. We have other barriers. Our residents believe that we know they're in pain. I tell my residents on admission, I'm a really good nurse, but I'm not psychic. You've got to talk to me. You've got to tell me if you're having pain. I tell family members, if you see something, you need to let us know. If you think that the resident is in pain, you need to tell us. And we need to empower our staff to report signs and symptoms that they believe are indicative of pain in their residents. And that empowerment extends beyond the nursing staff, beyond the physicians. It extends to our nursing assistants, our recreation staff. I will tell you, when I first started in pain management, I got some of my best referrals from dietary maintenance and housekeeping. You know why? When my residents weren't telling me and the nursing staff about pain, they were telling the woman who emptied the trash or the maintenance guy who fixed the air conditioner. Well, a lot of good that's going to do if these folks don't know about the need to report and the harmful effects of pain and the fact that pain is not a normal consequence of aging. We need to educate our staff. We need to educate our residents and their families. Let's talk about some of the facts with regards to pain. Acute and chronic pain are serious problems for 20 to 30% of the United States population. Do you know how I know this?